Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. In this hour, former President Trump and his allies have made no secret of their intentions, should he return to the White House, to move the country from democracy and rule of law to something more akin to authoritarianism. What would that mean? We begin a series on the question. And Stu Johnson visits something we don't see very much of these days, a tobacco farm. First, some of the consequences now being experienced and felt of a changing climate and extreme weather events. Dr. Jeremy Porter joins us from the First Street Foundation, where he is head of climate implications. Jeremy holds PhDs in demography and applied statistics and geospatial technologies, a master's in urban geography, as well as a bachelor's in sociology from his hometown school, the University of Louisville. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me on. I'm always happy to talk with you.
So first, a big, broad question that I think everybody is wondering about, but are these disasters that are related to climate increasing in frequency and impact?
With most measurements, we're seeing that, in fact, we do have more water in the streets. We have more wildfires, more areas burned, more tropical cyclones with heavy extreme wind events. So we are seeing these events more often. But what we generally use to measure the occurrence of these events are the damages that are associated with them, how they impact the places where people live. And if you look at those trends, NOAA tracks what are called the billion-dollar disasters. And the NOAA billion-dollar disasters have risen dramatically since about 2020, but they've been collecting the information since 1980. There's been about $2.65 trillion in damages in climate events that are just over $1 billion. So you can also imagine all the events that don't hit that threshold and adding those up on top. But if you just look at that trend line, there's clear evidence that we're seeing more damages from climate events today than we have in the past.
Are certain parts of the country seeing more damage than others?
Every part of the U.S. is affected by some type of climate hazard, whether it's extreme precipitation in the Midwest, wildfires in the West, tropical cyclones and hurricanes in the Southeast, heat waves across the southern and middle part of the country. But what we end up seeing is that parts of the country where the largest damages are occurring tend to be in California, in Texas, in Florida. They're parts of the country where we have huge populations, huge amounts of development. And because of that, we have a lot of opportunity for damages from these climate events.
Does your research look into what people are taking into account when they're thinking about moving, getting out of harm's way? And is climate risk a factor in those moves?
Yeah, that's an interesting or really the focal point of our research. We started out by looking at sort of the movement of populations historically, and people have been historically moving from the Rust Belt to the Sun Belt. That's kind of the macro migration trend from the north to the south. More opportunity, more jobs, more amenities, better weather in lots of cases in the southern states, and people are moving there. But also, we started to see research come out that was indicating that if you expose people to climate information, they were taking that information and using it in the decision-making process about where to live. So there's a Redfin study, for instance, that used climate information on their site. They exposed half the people that came to the site to climate information. They didn't expose the other half. And the people that were exposed systematically searched for lower risk properties than the other group. So there you started to see this information that didn't really line up with those macro trends, right? Moving from the north to the south, the national narrative is people have been moving to risk. People are flocking to wildfire areas, they're flocking to flood areas. But if you kind of think about the ways in which people move, they tend to move more locally. So, you know, if you think about your last 10 friends, they probably moved within the same county or within the same city or within the same metro area, as opposed to moving clear across the country. Not always the case, but sometimes it is. And if you account for those types of moves, those make up about 80-85% of all residential mobility every year. So by looking at these huge moves that we're talking about across the country from the north to the south, we're really ignoring the majority of moves that happen across the country. And our focus was to say, all right, let's take that majority of moves. Let's take high resolution population data from the Census Bureau from 2000 to 2020. Let's take our high resolution flood layer, and let's see if there's any kind of relationship between places that have high risk of flooding and the changes in populations that we've seen over that 20-year time period.
Well, here in our area, which would be central and eastern Kentucky, the biggest risks come from
flooding, occasional tornadoes, straight line winds. We can sometimes get a humdinger of an ice storm in the middle of the winter that does a lot of damage and knocks out power. But flooding is a big one, especially in recent years. The major flood that hit eastern Kentucky happened almost a year and a half ago, but it seems like only yesterday. And your research looked at whether people are responding to flood risk by moving away from areas known for flood risk. What did you find?
Yeah, we found that there was a clear negative effect of flood risk on population growth over time. So said another way, places that have high risk of flooding either aren't growing as fast as places with lower risk or actually seeing declining populations from 2000 to 2020. And, you know, there's a couple of different reasons why we see that. Sometimes it is the exposure, the big flood events that occurred, like in eastern Kentucky. People don't want to rebuild in the flood zone and live in the same area. Some people move away, some people stay. In the end, it may result in smaller populations that were there before the flood event. In the other cases, there are sort of these high-frequency flood events, things like tidal flooding or frequent heavy precipitation events that maybe flood low-lying areas, and you see a lot of ponding around homes, and water gets into basements, and people just don't want to deal with the repeated damages or the nuisance of the flooding occurring frequently. And people are responding based on that. We're seeing that these sort of hyper-local or really, really small geographic areas where we're using census blocks, they usually contain about 100 people within each block. The ones with really high flood risk, a lot of them were actually seeing negative population change over that time period versus very, very similar census tracts or census blocks with very similar socioeconomic characteristics, age distributions, race and ethnicity information that don't have the same flood risk.
So if you would boil that down, what does that mean?
That means that people understand that there's a lot of flood risk in an area, and they're taking that information and making decisions to move to areas that aren't quite as risky.
Well, your latest report has an interesting title, Climate Abandonment Areas. What are climate abandonment areas?
There are about 11 million blocks across the whole country, census blocks. We found that 2.9 million of them already have enough flood risk to where there's some negative impact on flooding. Most of those, about 2.1 million of them, ultimately are still seeing population growth. There are amenities in the area that are drawing people in that's stronger than the disamenity of flood. But in about 800,000 of those blocks, we actually saw negative population change. We actually saw in a country that grew by 18%, pretty evenly across the whole country. There are certainly areas that grew faster than others, but almost every state gained population over this time period. There are actual blocks within these counties and within these communities that are actually losing population. So we're seeing that while population is increasing unevenly and oftentimes directly in relation to the flood risk.
It's going to be really interesting to keep up with what you track as time goes on. And we're always interested in the information that you and your team there at First Street provide. What's next? What are you working on?
This model is coming out in one of the top academic journals right now, Nature Communications, but we're also working on a multi-peril version of it. This paper really just focuses on flood. Currently, we're integrating wildfire risk, extreme wind risk, extreme heat risk, drought risk, and even smoke from wildfires into the same type of model to see if we can see other climate effects on population change. Ultimately, our goal is to understand how populations are responding to climate risk at large across the country, and then to start thinking about derivatives of that risk. You know, if people start moving away from the communities, what does that do for commercial viability? What does that do for school quality? What does it do for property values? So you want to, you know, not only is it that kind of first order effect, but there are always these sort of community implications that kind of trickle down after that.
All right, going to be really interesting to follow. It's Dr. Jeremy Porter, head of climate implications at the First Street Foundation. Thank you so much, Jeremy.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather since my man and I ain't together. Keeps raining all of the time.
As we just heard in the interview with Jeremy Porter from the First Street Foundation, in recent years there has been ample evidence that the frequency of unstable weather events is increasing. Think about the tornadoes in our west, the flooding in our east, and we had some wildfires in a number of spots back in early November. The region is tinder dry from drought. Concern about all of this can add up. People who tend to our mental health are seeing this. Is there anything we can do to protect ourselves from these mental health risks of climate change? Well, climate anxiety is a recurrent central theme in Bill Nunley's psychiatric practice and work as a psychoanalyst. And Bill joins us from Louisville. Welcome, Dr. Nunley.
Thank you.
In your practice, are you seeing more patients with issues that relate somehow to climate change and extreme weather?
Unlike some psychiatrists, I also have a public health background. So I do think some of why I see folks seeking services with me related to this, either secondarily, which is most common, or at times primarily, because I do have a background in public health and thinking about how the environment impacts mental health. And so I do think for me, part of that is some folks seek me out for this, but it is something that I see. I have a bit of a unique practice. I'm in Louisville, Kentucky, but as you mentioned, I'm also a psychoanalyst. I was for 15 years out in Oregon. So I was out there during the beginning of the wildfire. And when I was in training, was actually seeing a fair number of people that for the first time were developing true psychiatric symptoms related to, a whole host of names related to this, but general eco-anxiety symptoms that started to manifest and cause deep suffering for them.
Well, is climate in some way a central cause of the anxieties that you're seeing, or is it more complicated than that? Climate intersecting with economic frustrations, maybe some disillusionment with leadership and authority, that whole cocktail of complaints.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. From a public health perspective, research has helped some people present with anxiety in other areas, and then during effective treatment will identify, oh, actually, I'm really frightened. You know, I've got close friends or my family back east has had flooding, you know, these classic stories that in our communities we are hearing. And so it really is that some people will start to identify real deep fears about the future. What's concerning in my practice in the literature is that often this is disproportionately held by adolescents, kids and adolescents specifically. You know, the literature is pretty broad, anywhere from 25 to 40% increase. But during the pandemic, younger folks started to have much more intense anxiety and actually disillusionment. Because this is such an actively debated political issue, there really is a sense that we may not solve these challenges. We either may stay in denial or not solve them. And that really does hold both in my practice and in the literature. Younger people are more affected by some of the strain, limited resilience and hopefulness to address this very complex issue.
Well, if we were a fly on the wall in your office, what does climate anxiety look like? What are the symptoms, if you will?
For me, the challenging piece is that so often anxieties, you know, big picture anxieties, fears, you know, some of that can be pathologized. You know, the sense that in my office, people often are coming with secondary issues. Oh, I'm struggling at school, or I'm struggling with my spouse or at work if they're older. And where deeper work gets to some of the core questions of, look, do I live in a safe world? Do I live in communities that can solve these large problems? So at an individual basis, it really does matter on the subjectivity. Each person will describe concerns about just basic facts. You know, is the earth heating up by 2 degrees? Do we really believe this? What does this mean for me, my world, to my children, sort of dynamics that really each person is addressing? And so if you were in my practice, there really are in some ways two practices. One of the unique things about my practice is I work with people through telesessions. So I get to see people in very small communities in Kentucky and in Oregon. If somebody has had direct impact, my insurance rates have gone up or there's been a flood and I actually don't get support, then those tend to present, as you described, Tom, traditional PTSD or general anxiety symptoms that we work with the content of the fears and the stuckness that goes with trauma. That's different in Oregon on large part. It's just undeniable. You know, for about a week before I moved back, right before the pandemic, it looked like Mars. And so literally the sky was red, and a lot of people who had never thought about global warming or these beyond political debates really were coming with, look, I am deeply afraid. I'm having nightmares about this. And so the work really is helping somebody talk about their fears, both the manifest content, as it were. I'm afraid. What, you know, is, are we going to have an earthquake? Those sort of symptoms. But to really get into, do I believe and trust that I'm in a safe enough world where we can solve these problems? For my patients in Kentucky, most of them are secondary. You know, I work with healthcare providers, and so people will talk about fever and the pandemic is, you know, or what we're doing in the world causing these problems. And so in some ways, it looks somewhat differently depending on the community that you come from.
As a society, are we sensitive enough about this, Bill? Are we getting past the stigmas around mental health?
There are aspects of this that really are changing for younger people. Younger people are seeking mental health treatment. Thankfully, we're changing mental health treatment. We no longer are just focused on, you know, one person of some wealth thinking about, you know, these Freudian ideas that I tend to think really deeply about. We're changing the type of therapies to be more adaptive for folks and communities that will not seek treatment in some ways that's more traditional. And also, yeah, we know that most people who have severe anxieties, the most common set of medical conditions, don't seek treatment. They don't feel like it's appropriate for them. It isn't what their family does. It's not what their community does often. And so the harder answer is that, yes, people are overcome by stigma and not seeking treatment, and specifically related to fears around the environment. You know, I've got a list in front of me. We've called this thing so many different things, Tom. Eco-anxiety, solastalgia, which is a fancy word, eco-guilt, ecological grief. You know, we call it just the research body shows us that there really are these different prioritizations and language around a fear of the earth not being safe or even inhabitable for some. For some, that's a true terror state, you know, panic attack, nightmares. I can't not think about this obsessive qualities to it. And to be fair to my colleagues and me, mental health really has struggled some to identify this, to respond to this, to just recently start to focus on what are the training programs that can start to address this? This is in its infancy as far as how do we work effectively to address these fears.
Well, what would you say about these emotional issues concerns you most?
Well, as a physician, you know, there's this old adage, you can only treat what you identify. I think that this is an overwhelming set of conditions, right? So I think you have to compartmentalize this level of fear to get up and do the things you want to do, to love your family, go to work or go to school. So I think the scope of it's alarming. You know, I don't know the other programs on what they've said, but the amount of economic and social change that's needed is for most people just immobilizing. So that's one. Two, I think the challenges of mental health are formidable. We live in an individual focused society. And so the resilience that's needed to endure the stress and or the symptoms of anxiety is one that we, compared to some other cultures, have somewhat underperformed with. Hmm. And so there is a piece for me, I'm an optimist, I couldn't do what I do for a living if I wasn't. I think there generally is hope amongst this suffering that this can help us evolve and change to better meet, and for me, especially younger people's concerns. It simply is on a timeline now to where there will be such change over such a short amount of period that we will need to and have to adjust rapidly to help people have the emotional support, the connection at a family and community level to meet the needs of the set of changes that are being required.
All right. Well, that's Dr. Bill Nunley, psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, practicing in Louisville. Thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity and the work you're doing.
Right after those flash floods hit hard in eastern Kentucky in the summer of 22, recovery workers were predicting that the loss and the devastation was bound to show up later as some sort of mental health issues among survivors. And indeed, somebody has been looking into how issues around climate change are impacting sleep and other aspects of health in this area in the wake of the flooding. The effort is led by Crystal Badur, co-director of the Clinic for Emotional Health in the Department of Psychology at the University of Kentucky. And Crystal is with us now to talk about that research. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Badur.
Thank you so much for having me here today, Tom. I'm happy to be here.
So tell us what your research is looking into and how it works.
So we actually had a research project prior to the flooding in 12 counties in eastern Kentucky that was focused on trying to understand sleep in the region. And the reason for that is that it turns out that Kentucky actually ranks 48th out of 50 states in terms of overall sleep health. And the worst health in terms of sleep overall is really located in eastern Kentucky. And so we've been really trying to understand why that is. And so we had a project actually, it was centered in Whitesburg in Letcher County. And when the flooding hit, it really devastated, of course, the area and set back our research project. And we decided that it was important for us to sort of pivot and think about the communities that we were working with to try to understand how this flood experience had impacted both sleep health, but also mental health in the region, and thinking about what residents' needs might be long term in terms of their recovery in that space.
So your team's actually been listening to people talking about their experiences.
We have, yes. So we both did surveys as well as interviews with 25 residents as our initial round, just to get a sense of the lay of the land. And we did that about 9 months after the flood, and then again, 15 months after the flood, to really see where people were at that point.
There can be a stigma in the region around talking openly about mental health. Are people open to talking about how they're feeling about this?
Yes, it was definitely an issue that came up. People talked about some of the longstanding stigma, and then also just some of the logistical barriers of, if you did want to go talk to a counselor, there's usually one counselor and people will see your car in the parking lot. And so some of those kind of unique features to living in a very rural area. And what we did hear from residents was that while stigma was still a thing, in some ways the scope of the flooding and how it impacted so many people, it seemed like it maybe opened the door for people to be able to talk about this in ways that they hadn't in the past. But residents really talked to us still about wanting to have new and creative solutions, ways of accessing care via telehealth or web-based interfacing, so that maybe they didn't have to show up into the parking lot if they could get in to see a counselor, because there's also often a challenge of just having spaces open to go and talk to someone.
Including those suggestions from the community, have you been doing this work long enough for it to yield some early findings?
We do, yes. So one of the things that we were interested in getting a sense of is, to what degree are people being impacted by the flood as we've gotten more than a year out? And the most common thing that we heard people describe was actually insomnia. So sleep problems have really been they've had new problems that have come on since the flooding, or their existing sleep problems have been made worse. And so one thing that residents talked about with us was this idea that now anytime that it rains, they have a hard time sleeping. And so it can trigger some anxiety about not knowing whether a flood will happen again while people are asleep. So that was definitely a big piece. We also found that there was a high level of post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms in residents that we spoke with, as well as physical complaints that can be made worse by stress, so things like headaches and gastrointestinal problems, but then also depression and anxiety were common as well.
What are you finding in the way of attitudes and levels of concern around how climate change is impacting the health of people in eastern Kentucky, and is climate change bought into?
That was actually a question we were really interested in talking with residents about. And we found a mixture in terms of what participants' perspectives were. I would say by and large, most residents told us that they believed that climate change was real and that it was having an impact on their community. So many people talked about the fact that they think that storms are just getting worse as a result of climate change. And so likely the change in climate really did impact the degree to which this storm was as large as it was, but then that really intersected with other things that might be happening in the community in terms of lack of investment in infrastructure and resources. Some people expressed concerns around like manufacturing and mining processes that might have made it so that the flooding was worse in the area. And so there was definitely an intersection between concerns about climate change and sort of setting the stage for future disasters, alongside what we're doing to maybe not prepare ourselves as much and prepare our communities as much for the reality of this change.
As you're doing this research, are you getting a clear sense of what's needed to help flood survivors cope and to heal?
I think there's definitely a strong desire for help in this area. And I think there's a mixture of views on what's needed. Some people really talked about the desire to have an individual therapist or counselor to talk to, but a lot of people really talked about the strength of ties in their community and their desire to come together to generate solutions to improve available housing and other infrastructure, stronger pipes and roads, and things that could help to really help strengthen the community if there were a new disaster to come in the future. The other thing that people really talked about with us was concern around the children in the area, and that children have been impacted in a strong way, and that a lot of people feel like there's some difficulty in terms of how to help them cope and move forward given this current reality. So I think that's an area that we really do need more research on and how we can best provide those resources and support.
Well, given all that we know about the aftermath of the flood, this is definitely important work and going to be important information to have at hand. When do you hope to complete the work? And when you do, will you come back and share it?
Absolutely. So we actually have an extension to this grant. Our first step was a small grant just to get a sense of what the issues are. We actually now have a project to interview many more flood survivors and also to do surveys with them to ask them questions about further about their perceptions of how climate change might be impacting their mental health as well as physical health and sleep. And then we will also be looking at things like how fluctuations in temperature impact people's sleep over time, as well as things like access to air conditioning, particularly in the summer months. And so we'll be doing that work over the next year or so, and we'll actually be following people with their sleep health for the next few years. But we anticipate having some more interesting findings here within the next 6 months to a year and would love to come back and share more with you.
Well, you're certainly welcome to. We look forward to it. That's Crystal Bedour, co-director of the Clinic for Emotional Health in the Department of Psychology at the University of Kentucky. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
No, but just reach, reach, reach. I can feel it on the ends of my fingers and taste it on the tips of my teeth. So you see why I never get sleep.
Can't get no sleep. Don't know why.
If you've lived here in Kentucky for at least a couple of decades, you've probably noticed a big change in the landscape. WEKU's Stu Johnson has.
There was a time when swirling, leafy clumps of tobacco plants were found back to back to back along Kentucky's farming landscape. However, that's not the case today. With the health impacts of smoking well documented and consumption falling steadily over the years, full-time, only burly growers are hard to find. A father and son are still making that work on farmland on the Fayette-Clark County line.
Yeah, I mean, this barn here holds about, what, probably 6 acres? Mm-hmm. And it's just crop we've grown this year.
Ben Webb paints a picture as rows and rows of brown dried tobacco hang from the rafters of the barn that is over a century old. He and his dad, Benny, are fully involved in the burley growing business. The 62-year-old Elder Webb says he was just about raised in a tobacco barn.
When you got off school bus, you went to work in the fields and you was right there with your family and then stripping tobacco in these little strip rooms. I was in a crib when I was raised up in the stripping room.
Webb comes from a family with three generations of sharecropping, where the landlord allows a tenant to use the land in exchange for a share of the crop. They didn't take the federal tobacco buyout and continued to grow the leaf. Now, years later, the Webbs rent from three landowners and do the work to raise the crop, and it's been working out.
It's all in the yield. This is a very productive soil, and we yield 3,000 plus. We shoot for 3, and we've done over that many times. And that's what's kept us in the game.
That's 3,000 pounds per acre. Benny Webb says he started to lose some interest in tobacco production until his uncle came back to work on the farm along with his 33-year-old son.
I came back to the farm, I guess, about 10 years ago, and, you know, I do think there is long-term, you know, stability here for me. That's why I kind of have got back into it. I went back to school to finish my degree, but I did that just kind of as a backup plan.
The Webb say tobacco companies have been willing to pay more, realizing inflationary costs for farmers. Plus, Ben Webb says the fact there are so few Kentucky growers works in their favor.
There's so few of us, but that kind of opens a window for us to ramp up production. The people that are still doing it have an opportunity to continue growing, and I think that also offers some longevity too, because there's so few farmers that are doing it. That kind of keeps us, you know, in the ring.
In fact, the Ag Census figures show Kentucky had more than 59,000 farms growing tobacco in 1992. UK Ag economist Will Snell says that figure now hovers around 1,000. Webb says he could see himself diversifying some on the farmland by growing vegetables, adding there's a kind of niche market near Lexington, but he anticipates that remaining secondary to tobacco. Ben and Benny Webb spent some time growing hemp. They started with 3 acres and then ended up some 5 years later with 50 acres of hemp. Ben says the fourth year was really profitable, but then Benny says the fifth year was a different story.
So why did you decide to get out of hemp?
Because they didn't pay us our last year of it. They filed bankruptcy and they never paid the growers.
Ben says the hemp market was flooded and the excess was simply too much. Ask about the health impacts of cigarette smoking. Webb said bourbon is big in Kentucky, saying, quote, alcohol has its problems too, and I feel that people make their own choices. And the Webb say marijuana is smoked but doesn't seem to get the same attention as cigarettes. If one day Kentucky legalizes recreational marijuana, Ben Webb's not sure there would be an abundance of fields growing pot.
Talking to some professors at UK, I think marijuana does become legal here. I think it'll be kind of, it'll be people that have extensive backgrounds in greenhouse operations that'll probably be the ones growing it.
And Webb says there's still research to be done for alternative uses for tobacco, calling it one of the most genetic modifiable plants. For now, the Webb family will continue to grow tobacco. And this season, Benny Webb says the leaf had good color early, then dry conditions hit, but the yield has been very good. And both men say the price per pound is the highest ever, partly because of increased expenses to grow tobacco. So, no major changes on the farm for Benny and Ben Webb next season. I'm Stu Johnson in Lexington.
Coming up in a moment, when it comes to authoritarian types, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck.
They politicize independent institutions, they spread disinformation, they weaken checks and balances, they quash dissent and criticism, they marginalize vulnerable communities as a political tactic, they corrupt elections, and they stoke violence.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Berea College. With a commitment to serving Appalachian students, Berea has not charged tuition since 1892. All students participate in a paid work program, providing professional experience as well as an inclusive, supportive education. Details at berea.edu.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events and artist opportunities provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. Lead Center for the Arts in Winchester will host a 4-day stage combat intensive class January 11th through the 14th. Participants will learn the basic movements, attacks, and defenses of onstage swordplay. For information and to register, visit leadscenter.org. The Black and Lit Book Club, hosted by Lexington's Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning, will discuss the novel Homeward by Angela Jackson Brown, 6 to 7 p.m., January 8th on Zoom. The event is free, but registration is required. For more information, visit carnegiecenterlex.org.
And save the date, January 10th, to visit the state capitol in Frankfort for Arts Day in Kentucky. This special celebration is being presented by Kentuckians for the Arts. For more information on this event, visit kfta.wildapricot.org. I'm Sherry Lawson. Now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
There seems to be some consensus among people who observe national politics across the spectrum, left to right, that former President Trump's continued popularity confirms that many Americans don't seem all that wedded to democracy, and they seem tempted by extreme ideologies, the kind that animate authoritarian types. The former president's top allies have made no secret that they are preparing to radically reshape the federal government if he is reelected, plans that include remaking the executive branch to give him unprecedented power as president. What are we to think of this as we see fascism, authoritarianism, tyranny, and dictatorship gaining a foothold around the world? When we hear Mr. Trump praising people like Vladimir Putin and Viktor Orban, or borrowing from the language of Adolf Hitler. Now, some will say, pay no attention to all that. It's just the kind of bombastic, overblown talk we always hear as politicians are ramping up their campaigns in election year. But what if it's not? As we move into 2024, a year that could prove decisively pivotal for American governance and our way of life, I'll be talking with people who observe this, think about it, discuss it, debate it, write about it, so that we can understand what's happening, why, and what it could mean. And that begins now. We're joined by Jennifer Dresden, formerly Associate Director of the Democracy and Governance Program at Georgetown University, now a policy advocate at Protect Democracy. And on its website, the organization is described as a cross-ideological nonprofit group that uses litigation, legislative and communication strategies, technology, research, and analysis to stand up for free and fair elections, the rule of law, fact-based debate, and a better democracy for future generations. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Jennifer.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so first, just to clarify for our listeners, I mentioned that Protect Democracy describes itself as a cross-ideological group. So does that mean that voices from across the political and ideological spectrums are heard and considered in your decision-making?
So our mission is to prevent the United States from declining into a more authoritarian form of government. And we really firmly believe that containing the authoritarian threat will require a broad cross-ideological coalition of those who believe in democracy. So yes, our organization not only includes professionals on staff who are coming from all over the political spectrum, but we also partner with organizations of all kinds.
Again, for our listeners, these words are tossed around a lot these days, but I don't know that we really drill into them. If you could briefly give us a kind of a primer on what are fascism, socialism, communism, authoritarianism, tyranny, dictatorship, those kinds of things. What do those words really mean?
I think that the important thing is that when we look at those terms, they are all different variations on alternatives to democracy that are rooted in different ideologies, different ideas, different sort of forms of operating counter to the way that democracies operate. And I think the point to emphasize is that in our public conversation today, all of these terms are awesome for scoring political points. They are great for sound bites. But the important thing to really focus on is the health of our democracy and our system, not just to slap labels on things, but to have a consistent set of standards and criteria to understand and apply about the system that we have and that we need to protect.
Well, you've identified the seven characteristics of a democracy under strain. Can you talk to us about that? What are those characteristics?
When authoritarianism sort of comes into being these days, we might be tempted to think about big, single, crisis headline-grabbing events that we could point to very clearly and say, democracy collapsed on that day. But that's really not how it tends to happen around the world anymore. And instead, would-be authoritarians tend to use a playbook that has what we call sort of the seven tactics. And those would-be authoritarians, they politicize independent institutions, they spread disinformation, they weaken checks and balances, they quash dissent and criticism, they marginalize vulnerable communities as a political tactic, they corrupt elections, and they stoke violence.
Well, about those concerns that I raised in the introduction, are they an overreaction? Is it accurate to say that today's mainstream right has a much more openly authoritarian orientation than we've seen in the past?
Yeah, so this is where I think it's really important to have standards that are nonpartisan and apply to everybody so that we can give an answer to this question. There are three basic tests that political scientists use to consider whether a political group, a party, a faction can be considered pro-democracy. First, healthy actors in a democratic system have to unambiguously accept electoral defeat. Second, they have to reject violence. And then they have to also be willing to break with extremists in their own ranks, their own allies, who violate those first two principles. And if we look around today, there are countless individuals on the right who pass all three of those tests. But there's also a powerful faction on the right that has violated all three. And I think that that's where we see the shift. Any prior movements that may have been based in a set of ideas about what government should or shouldn't do or had a particular political style, whether or not you agree with those ideas or that style, that's very different than baselessly rejecting the results of an entire election. And that's really where the shift is.
When we're in conversations, it's not uncommon to hear frustrations with both major political parties, that the left, for example, has its own extremes. And we kind of get into some whataboutism here. But do you detect any appetite among people who identify as center-left or left for abandoning democracy? Is this movement pretty much exclusive to the right?
So it's definitely important to avoid false equivalency or whataboutism. And that, again, I think is why having standards that you could refer to, basic tests that are not partisan, is so important. And standards that are not couched in specific policy goals or what a group is pushing for. I think that if you apply those standards and those, you know, those three very basic tests that I outlined before, I think the difference where we see is not that there are not extremists on both sides. I think it's how powerful they are and how predominant they are is the question. And that's, I think, where we see the difference.
Well, your organization has published a guide for journalists. It's titled The Authoritarian Playbook: How Reporters Can Contextualize and Cover Authoritarian Threats as Distinct from Politics as Usual. And I'd like to talk about that distinction. What makes it necessary?
So what makes that distinction so necessary is particularly because of the piecemeal nature by which democracy collapses in the current era. Democracy is messy. It is competitive. American politics is boisterous, and it always will be. But that is different from what we've seen happening in recent years. And without both a reliable standard for what democracy needs and what threatens it, and information about the full context in which these seemingly small, eroding, drip, drip, drip actions happen, it can be very easy to miss until you wake up one day and realize how much has been lost already.
The guide suggests three balancing tests that journalists can use to sort through the chaos and the distractions and focus on real, honest-to-goodness, grave threats to democracy that call for urgent coverage. What are those tests? How do they work?
So the first thing is to look at how much an action deviates from recent precedent, right? How much is what we're seeing something that's actually new? Not all precedent is good precedent, certainly. But in general, that's the first question you want to ask. Are we seeing something change? Is something different about what we're seeing right now? And the second question is, to what degree is that happening? It's a very different matter if we're looking at sort of one loose cannon or somebody off on their own doing something that looks like a violation of democratic norms. But it's different if it's happening repeatedly over and over, or if it's happening to a really severe extent. And third is the really important question of whether the action is isolated or whether it presents a systemic risk. How are other actors in the space responding? When we were putting the playbook together, one thing we heard really clearly from experts was that the way an actor's allies respond, for example, is key. Is someone stepping in to constrain transgressions, to prevent them from expanding? If that's happening, then the system is sort of self-correcting in the way that democracy is meant to. Those checks and balances are happening. But if not, and the system's not responding, and those around an individual or a group taking this action are empowering or expanding it, that's when we really want to be concerned.
I've recently heard some people downplay concerns about an American abandonment of democracy. It's, you know, oh, that's just campaign rhetoric. They say that it won't really happen. Others say even if it happens, if such a shift occurs, it won't matter much on the local level. Well, you published and lectured on democratic and authoritarian politics for both academic and policy audiences, and you've done research in the U.S. and overseas. And I'm wondering, given what you know about what has happened to civil liberties in countries now under authoritarian rule, what can you tell us about how that could play out here in the USA?
So this piecemeal nature of it, the erosion, I think is the key here. It's very understandable to see all of this as a problem that happens, you know, far away in Washington, or that only impacts people who are, you know, worried about a certain particular set of things. But I think that there are two things that are really important to understand about this process, and for those who might see it just as campaign rhetoric. The first is that what political leaders say actually really does matter. Social science research from the United States, from overseas, makes clear that the way that the average person views things like political violence, for example, which is one of the tactics in the playbook, the way the average person sees political violence is hugely influenced by how the people that they support talk about it. So if the person you want to vote for says violence is okay, their supporters are more likely to agree that there might be some circumstances where violence is okay. So those words matter. And it's not just me saying this. At Protect Democracy, we have a tool that tracks experts' concerns about political violence's impact on our democracy in the U.S. And this concern about what elites are saying about political violence that might condone it, that consistently shows up as something of great importance to those experts. And in terms of the local level, you know, think about things like the right to protest or the ability to have an open conversation or debate in a classroom. Those are things that are important to lots of Americans. And it's abstract, it's fighting in Washington until your business can't run the way you want it to because of a question of speech or expression, or your kid comes home and tells you their teacher wasn't allowed to answer a question they asked in class. You know, it's not abstract. These things do matter to the way that people live their lives.
Well, we've been accustomed to living in a democracy with certain functions that operate with some independence from partisan politics. And I'm talking about things like central banking, law enforcement in the courts, official statistics, very important, financial accounting and regulation, election administration, intelligence, national security. What would you say are some of the most concerning attempts to politicize independent institutions here in the U.S.?
Yeah. So here again, I think this is an area where it is so important to have those objective standards that we can refer to, because it's one of those areas that if it becomes a political football, and it can become a political football really easily, that's very damaging to our ability to evaluate these things clearly. Two areas where I think we want to pay particular attention, where independent institutions really matter and need to be protected, are in election administration, first off. We have seen a wave of harassment of election officials over the last couple of years that is one of the most concerning things that democracy advocates are seeing around the country. So in 2024, for example, half of voters in Western states will have their elections administered locally by people who are new to the job since 2020. A lot of experienced administrators have left office in such huge numbers, in part because of the harassment that they have been facing. And, you know, not just independent, but high quality election administration is important and, you know, matters for how our democracy operates. And when it comes to politicization of other independent institutions, you know, some of the things that you mentioned in your introduction, some of the proposals that have been put forward that would make huge swaths of the civil service political appointees, enabling the, you know, the leadership of our institutions to be not based on expertise or ability, but on political loyalty. That really threatens the health and the productivity of our democracy.
Well, you you touched on this a few moments ago. I'd like to ask you if you could expand on it just a bit. And that is, in a practical sense, what happens to life in a country where control of such functions of government winds up concentrated in its leader, in one person?
Yeah. When independent institutions are no longer independent and that power is concentrated in the hands of a leader, a couple of things can happen. First, the general quality of government tends to go down. In non-democracies where power is concentrated in that way and decisions are made primarily based on loyalty or political expediency, those non-democracies, they tend to do worse on things like health and education. The second thing, though, is that when functions of government like that are concentrated in the hands of a single individual, it really degrades trust. If people perceive election administration to be corrupted, they don't trust election outcomes. If they don't trust the basic statistics that they use to do things like make business decisions, or even have trust in the same basic facts when disinformation is spread with abandon, that leads to a real decline in trust and a decline in civic engagement. And that's something that makes us Americans, right? One of the things that has historically stood out about the United States internationally is how engaged we have been in our communities and our civic life. So the concentration of power in that way, you know, it's bad for the quality of government, but it's and the quality of public services, but it also has a real impact, I think, on our civic culture. That would be a real loss.
Jennifer, do you think the American educational system ought to fully restore the teaching of civics, how democracy actually works? And if you believe so, how early in life should this begin, do you think?
Yeah, democracy is for everyone. And there are certainly lessons for 3-year-olds and 30-year-olds and 90-year-olds. Neighbors, journalists, faith leaders, the business community, we all have a role to play. And civics education can certainly reinforce that. But that being said, I think we don't have time to wait for a new generation of Americans to grow up with a new wave of civic education. The concerns that we've been talking about here today are present and they're happening now. And strong civic education is really important for our future, but we need to get to that future. And that's the problem we face right now.
That's Jennifer Dresden, policy advocate at Protect Democracy. Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, partners, and more, and you can sign up there for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get podcasts. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu, and we do get back to you. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.